been asked here to speak today about what are some of the lessons from our organizing efforts in 2008 at the Republican National Convention. And first of all, I think that this march that we organized was significant. We organized over 30,000 people to come out to protest against the Republican war agenda at a time in which the anti-war movement hadn't had a march like that, particularly in the heartland of that size. We united different parts of the anti-war movement, including the principal centers of the anti-war movement, the Troops Out Now Coalition, United for Peace and Justice, and ANSWER. And we helped the anti-war movement connect with other movements for peace and justice, including the student movement, organized labor, and the immigrant rights movement. And while the eyes of the world were on St. Paul, we were able to send a clear and united anti-war message that was loud and said unanimously that we wanted the troops out of Iraq, and that message was heard around the world. Some of the lessons that we learned from this organizing effort is that we created unity among a lot of different types of forces using a broad slogan, money for human needs and not for war. And we used this unity to create a mass march on the first day of the Republican National Convention on Labor Day. Other groups, including the Anti-War Committee, which I'm a part of, organized protests for other days using more militant tactics. But part of our success is that we used the unity we had for organizing on day one, and we used that unity for organizing this march and realized what we had unity about and didn't try to stretch that unity in a way that broke the coalition. We did not try to put some of the signers onto the march, like, for example, organized labor in a situation in which they would have to withdraw from the coalition. But also, one of our successes that we focused early. Our coalition was organizing one thing together and organizing something very well. But that didn't mean that we thought that the other days should go empty, because they definitely didn't. Every day in St. Paul was a day of protest. One of the ways that we coordinated things locally is that there were actually two groups that were formed. One was the March on the RNC, but the other was a network locally called Protest RNC 2008, which functioned as an information clearinghouse, a consultative body, and it was the way that we prevented misunderstandings between different forces. It helped us prevent the state from pitting us against each other and gave us a vehicle by which to actually implement the St. Paul principles, which we're going to talk about here today. It meant that we could actually negotiate who got to have their protests where and when, and to talk to each other instead of letting the media and the state try to pit us off against each other. One of the main battles that we had in organizing the RNC was that we had to fight for our right to protest. And there are really two avenues in which we did this. One was the legal fight. And the fact is that we started that fight very early on. We went right as we heard that the state was going to be organizing this event in St. Paul, and we requested permits on all 4 days for a bazillion different places, et cetera, because we wanted to try to secure that organizing space for the anti-war movement. But we didn't wait until the legally defined time period in which we were allowed to apply, because the fact is that St. Paul, like most cities, has an ordinance, which is ridiculous, which says that you can't actually apply for the permit until January 1 of that year. But as Joe pointed out, is the state waiting until the year of the event in order to organize their event? No way. And if you wait until their legally defined time period, all of the city is going to be ending up being used for the people that we want to protest against. And so we started that legal organizing effort early. And then lastly, we asked for the best possible march route possible. We wanted to march from the state capitol to the convention center, around the Excel Center, and then leave. And we didn't get the march route that we wanted, but we did get to be very close to the Excel Center. And that's because we demanded the very best possible march route, as opposed to asking to be in the same city and then hoping and then ending up in Minneapolis, which is what they would have done to us. But also, we did not just have a behind the doors, you know, process for trying to get a permit. We had also a battle for the hearts and minds of the people in the Twin Cities, and we had a battle in the court of public opinion, which in my opinion is way easier to win than any battle in a court of law. And what we did is we had call-in days. We had protests outside of city council meetings, protests outside of, you know, the mayor's office. But we had a very public fight for the right to protest. But we didn't just have the fight be about freedom of speech. We used the First Amendment to talk about the issues that we actually wanted to protest about. We never merely said, we want to have a protest. We always talked about was the substance, the issue of substance that we wanted to protest about. We wanted the right to protest the war on Iraq. We did not just want the right to protest. And so we used these events to build for our march, as well as we used these events to try to pressure the city and the court of law. One of the things that we also did is that we organized the St. Paul Principles, which said that we should respect a diversity of tactics, understanding that there are a lot of ways to protest the Republican agenda, and we wanted people to use all of them. And that even though we, as an organization, were organizing a mass permitted march, we wanted there to be space for all sorts of tactics to be used against the Republicans. We also said that we wanted there to be a separation of time and space so that people could organize their events, but respect the fact that different groups wanted to use different tactics. And then lastly, we said that we did not want to cooperate with law enforcement. At every press conference, the media tried to bait me into denouncing the other people who were organizing in town. I'm not going to say that it's easy, but you really become like those politicians who they ask one question and you give a different answer. I was like that. Meredith, what do you have to say about these people who want to throw rocks? We're organizing an excellent march on day one of the RNC, you know? And so, or they would say, what about people who want to come and commit violence? I'd be like, you know who are the committers of violence? The U.S. and Iraq, and what they're doing in Iraq is horrible, you know? And I've already seen that type of principled action from people here in Chicago, and I think that that's important, because the fact is that the unity that we created in Minneapolis around through these St. Paul principles have served us well. One, our marches and our actions in Minneapolis are bigger now than they were before the RNC, and I totally credit that to the unity that we created. Two, that unity that we used was instrumental in helping the RNC 8, who were targeted for state prosecution after the Republican National Convention. And last of all, that unity has been essential in helping those of us in the Minnesota Committee to stop FBI repression. And so I guarantee you that unity will help build this march, as well as help you in the days afterwards. One of the last things that we did is that we encouraged people to organize contingents. And some of those contingents were organized by members of our coalition, but others of them were organized because we went and met with different constituencies to encourage them. And they frequently marched under their own slogans, which is one of the things that Marilyn was talking about. But we had contingents of students, of Somalis, of organized labor, and the urban poor. And those contingents really made it possible for people who didn't consider themselves a part of the anti-war movement to feel like they were a part of the anti-war movement. And it made our march broader and more diverse, and I think that particularly lots of people have reasons to hate the G8 and NATO, and I think that encouraging that could be very successful here. The last lesson is that we unfortunately underestimated the amount of surveillance going on in our organizing. That wasn't intended to be funny. Well, we wished we would have understood that we had undercover agents coming to our meetings, or in my case, my home, and joining groups in the coalition. The fact is, our movement faced tremendous growth at that time, and we wouldn't have been able to grow or organize a massive march if we wouldn't have trusted people or welcomed new people. The state tried to create a climate of fear, and these national security events always use fear-mongering to try to prevent people from taking to the streets to demand a better future. And I commend the organizers here in Chicago for already aggressively fighting back the violence baiting that this Chicago police force has already started. In conclusion, we in Minneapolis are excited to be a part of this coalition and to help build for this protest. It is critical that when war makers come to our towns, that we stand up, we protest, and we refuse to welcome these people to our communities.
Who I've only actually laid eyes on this morning for the first time. Pete is active with the Thomas Merton Center of Pittsburgh and a member of the UNAC Administrative Committee. And we're moving from 2008 with Meredith to 2009 for the Pittsburgh protests against the G20. Pete.
Thank you, Joe. I'm with the anti-war committee at the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh. Can you all hear me in the back? I don't have a very loud voice, so I'm gonna. Okay, I'll try. We organized the People's March on the G20 in 2009 in Pittsburgh, demanding money for human needs, not for war. And about 7,000 people came out. That was the largest protest in Pittsburgh since the 70s. Very significant for Pittsburgh. We're hoping to bring at least one bus to the protest here in Chicago in May. We learned a lot of the same things that Meredith talked about that they learned in the Twin Cities. In fact, we had the Pittsburgh principles of cooperation that were based on the St. Paul principles. So I'm going to try to talk about a few different lessons that we learned, because I'm sure we could both go on for hours talking about what we learned. What I learned is that this is not only going to be a battle for permits. It's going to be a battle for the hearts and minds of the people. On one side of this battle is the government and their repressive national security, police state, military machine apparatus, and austerity policies that have caused this prolonged recession. On the other side of this battle is us, the protesters, and peacemakers. The government wants to get a PR gain from these summits, and they will oppose anybody who's going to protest them. They will try to paint us as violent and unreasonable. Our struggle is to expose them for the violent war makers that they are, and to show ourselves as the peaceful people that we are, who recognize the need to reorient the system away from war into serving the needs of the people and the planet. So this information and public perception struggle is so important because it will directly affect the amount of political space that we will have to organize. They will be claiming that we are violent and unreasonable in order to justify repressing our civil liberties. They will attempt to scare people away from attending the protest by saying that they will be violent. But if we're successful in waging an information campaign, we can expand the space that we can organize in, and we can win the hearts and minds of the people. So I'm just going to give you a few examples of the types of repression that we experienced in Pittsburgh, hoping that that will help you all to prepare for what's going to happen in May. The level of repression in Pittsburgh was higher than during any other protest that we had ever organized in Pittsburgh. They tried to divide us by politics, anarchists versus non-anarchists. They tried to divide us by local versus national. They eventually said, well, you local protesters, okay, but we're afraid of the dangerous radicals coming in from out of town. now that's going to be me, so. not that I am. Yeah. Yeah. But seriously, they actually co-opted some labor unions into not working with us. They imposed a McCarthyistic cloud of repression over the campuses. They threatened university professors and staff with expulsion if they worked with us publicly. And because the Secret Service takes over security for these national security events, there was a massive police and military presence. They shut down stores, they denied permits, they harassed activists, they confiscated some cameras, and they wrongfully arrested and even brutalized people. I was one of the people who was wrongfully arrested, along with over 100 other people. So now I'm going to talk about some of the specific measures that we took that I thought were effective in addressing this repression. To address the huge levels of fear that they had created, we co-sponsored nonviolence and peace martial training with the American Friends Service Committee. And we co-sponsored a public meditation for peace that helped to calm people. To win the hearts and minds of the people, one group made pamphlets about why we're protesting. And they went door to door in several communities near where the protests were being held. And they gave out thousands of these pamphlets and talked to people about why we're protesting. We had a civil liberties group that served all of the groups during the mobilization. They organized a special session of city council, and they brought in Heidi Bogosian, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, to talk about the huge cost of civil liberties lawsuits and ask that city council be an ally in defending our civil liberties. City council can be a key ally of us, but the government may also try to get them to pass repressive measures, but we can go to city council ourselves. And we had media experts help us. And we held training sessions for spokespeople, so to learn how to effectively talk to the media, because there's going to be a lot of opportunity to talk to the media. And we actually found out that we need more spokespeople just to handle all the interview requests. So we'll talk more about this in the media working group. So I'm going to wrap it up. I don't want to go over time, because I know Joe's going to take me off the podium here.
It's not me, it's Eldon.
Oh, Eldon. Oh, okay.
Eldon's sitting in the second row. He's watching you.
Yeah, he looks pretty
so
tough.
Mean, right?
Yeah. So, given the massive amounts of police and military presence and repression that they will likely impose, I think a more appropriate name for these summits would be the NATO G8 invasion of Chicago. So we'll be talking more about organizational structure later today, but I think it should be based on the following ideas. We, from outside Chicago, we stand in full solidarity with you all, and we will work with you in defending everybody's rights. We're going to have to fight for the right to fight and to get our message out. Let's form a united front with the broadest possible participation from across the peace and justice and people's movements. Now I'm going to ask everybody in this room who is not from Chicago to please stand up. This is what I think our motto should be. When I say Chicago, I want you all to say, "We got your back." Chicago, we got your back. Chicago, we got your back. Chicago, we got your back. Thank you.
All right.
We have Barry Weisletter. Weisletter, sorry. He's a longtime anti-war activist, a member of the Toronto Coalition to Stop the War, an affiliate of the Canadian Peace Alliance, and the organizer of the Toronto Substitute Teachers Union, now part of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation. Barry is a writer and a candidate for the Ontario Legislature representing the New Democratic Party in Thornhill riding. And he is taking us to the next year, 2010. He played a leading role in the protests there in Toronto in 2010 against the G8.
Good morning. I think it still is. Good morning, sisters and brothers. Two positive developments can be traced to the Toronto G20 summit protests. One is the pledge by the Ontario government to rescind the Public Works Protection Act, that odious law enacted in 1939 and secretly invoked by the Liberal provincial government just weeks before the G20 summit, encouraged police to arrest anyone approaching the summit security perimeter. Two is the change of the Canadian political landscape on May 2nd of this year. The complicity of the federal and Ontario Liberals with the Stephen Harper federal conservative government and its attack on civil liberties opened the eyes of many working people. It helped to catapult the labor-based New Democratic Party into second place with 103 seats in the Canadian Parliament and official party status there for the first time in history. That brings us to the G20 summit. How best to describe it? Well, I would describe it as a festival of the oppressors. It wasn't just a $1 billion photo op for the world's top capitalist politicians. It was a brutal demonstration of police power and a platform for the ongoing business campaign to destroy a century of working class gains. And from Athens to Wisconsin, we see this agenda unfolding. As for the working class, we got the bill for $1 billion, and that included sound cannons, an array of surveillance equipment, which the Toronto Police decided to keep, and $4.4 million for the security fence, and lots more. During the G20 summit in Toronto, police arrested over 1,100 people. That is more than double the number incarcerated in the October 1970 Quebec crisis. Those old enough will remember that Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau invoked the infamous War Measures Act in October 1970 in a vain attempt to quash the Quebec independence movement. In June 2010, in Toronto, most people caught up in the police sweep were released without charges, but only after being held in filthy cages in a makeshift jail for up to 24 hours without adequate food, water, medication, toilet facilities, without privacy for females, or access to legal aid. Police charged hundreds and dropped the charges on almost all of them. The business media worked feverishly to spin the results of the G20 meeting into a tapestry of triumph, an ode to worldly consensus, and a tribute to Canadian hospitality. But you know, it was kind of a hard sell, especially in light of the lockdown of the Toronto City Core and the acts of petty vandalism that police permitted to occur before they resorted to the use of tear gas, pepper spray, beatings, and mass arrests. Many peaceful protesters, working journalists, downtown shoppers, and curious onlookers were snared, or kettled, a new term, by the cop tactics. Over 300 people were surrounded and held by police at a downtown intersection for over 4 hours, much of the time forced to stand in pouring rain. Inside the media bubble of the World Capitalist Summit, much ado was made of the pre-arranged agreement. This betrayed the actual farce of the high-level gathering. It could have been conducted on Skype for free. The measures endorsed by the G20 leaders have extended the global recession, increased the misery of workers and the poor, and quickened the descent into environmental disaster. So protests filled the week of June the 20th. They followed the People's Summit. Now, the People's Summit was a weekend educational gathering, a counter-conference comprised of dozens of forums, seminars, and displays. And it was attended by over 1,500 people at the downtown Toronto's Ryerson University. Street protests started with the anti-repression march on June 21st, a climate justice rally on June 23rd, a demonstration for Aboriginal rights on June 24th, and a march against the rising tide of poverty on June 25th. They culminated in a massive rally and march on Saturday, June 26th. Up to 30,000 people participated despite persistent rainfall and despite media-amplified warnings of violence. The main Saturday demonstration set out from the provincial legislature grounds at Queen's Park. Sponsors included the Canadian Labour Congress, the Ontario Federation of Labour, and all of its major affiliates, auto, steel, public sector unions, and so on, as well as the Council of Canadians, Greenpeace, Oxfam, the Canadian Federation of Students, the Ontario Health Coalition, Amnesty International, and numerous feminist organizations. The demonstration was peaceful and spirited. Marchers chanted, "Whose streets? Our streets." And this is what democracy looks like. But the huge parade never made it onto the primetime news coverage. The media fixated on a tiny breakaway group. You see, a small number of people tried to breach the perimeter fence, and then they went on a window-smashing rampage that hit 40 businesses and torched 4 police squad cars. Now, no one was killed. No one was even seriously injured. The only injuries were caused by the police, and those occurred hours after these developments in the free speech zone. Anger against social injustice is understandable, but peaceful mass unity and action is crucial. The few examples of vandalism gave the cops ammunition to brutalize and jail over 1,100 innocent people and to use the powers of the secret law I mentioned before. Now, long after the G20 summit, many questions remain unanswered. Why did 20,000 cops, literally hundreds of them standing within a block or two of burning vehicles and smashed store windows, just let it happen? Was it an exercise in PR or in policing? Anger over the hundreds of arbitrary arrests and the dehumanizing treatment meted out by police to detainees spurred over 3,000 people to demonstrate outside Toronto Police Headquarters on June 28th. They demanded a full independent public inquiry. Thousands marched to City Hall and back to the legislature at Queen's Park. Many in the youthful throng chanted, "Wasted, wasted, $1 billion. And they chanted, "No justice, no peace." And again, whose streets? Our streets. More rallies and demonstrations occurred in July and August, each demanding that police charges be dropped and that the cops and politicians be held accountable for their actions. So where do things stand now, 14 months after the Toronto summit? While the secret fence law is still in place, after several investigations into police misconduct, 3 criminal charges have been brought against 2 cops. 109 officers have been docked a day's pay, about $300, for removing either their name tag or their badge number. Of the 317 people who still face charges after the G20, 24 pleaded guilty, 56 are still before the courts. And meanwhile, 2 class action lawsuits were filed against the police. Civil liberties groups and the New Democratic Party demand a full public inquiry into the G20 summits. That continues. Of course, Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty say no. They argue that the five inquiries underway are quite enough, thank you very much, including the police investigating themselves. In summary, we proceed to build the protests against the NATO G8 summit in Chicago next May. Many slings and arrows should be anticipated. There will be huge security expenditure, you know this. It will fund an army of cops, an array of surveillance technology, a big makeshift jail, and a lockdown of the central business district. The establishment will try to divert public attention from the mass, peaceful, permitted, I hope, anti-war movement and focus on instances of violence which may be partly planned by the authorities. While public opinion sided with the cops at the start in Toronto, every expose of malfeasance and brutality has accelerated the shift to critical opposition to the authorities. By publicizing the lessons of Pittsburgh, Toronto, and G8 summit experiences further afield, we can minimize the impact of the rulers' agenda and maximize the impact of democratic, mass, peaceful, anti-war action. And I use the term we deliberately in terms of planning this. We are in this struggle against war and militarism together. It is a global problem for which there's only global solutions. International solidarity is not a luxury. It is a principle because it is a necessity. And we will do all we can in Canada to organize protest actions on October 15th, which is the 10th anniversary of the war by Canadian, American, and NATO forces in Afghanistan. We will do all that we can in Canada to support and participate in activities in Chicago next May to give NATO and G8 leaders the reception they truly deserve. And as a longtime Canadian anti-war activist, union organizer, and NDP militant, I'm glad that UNAC and other forces of the broad anti-war movement in this country issued a call for international solidarity actions this October and next May. Together, we will stop the war makers, and we will build a better world.
Andy Thayer represents the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism and the Gay Liberation Network. He is one of the best-known anti-war activists in Chicago and has been in the forefront of the struggle here to defend our right to protest. Andy.
First of all, I'd like to say to Barry that it is up to those of us in the United States to have your back for all the Canadian and other international protesters who want to attend Chicago in May, because if past history is any indication, they'll try and lock down the borders for our Canadian and other brothers and sisters from abroad, and it's up to us to raise a stink with the Obama administration about its suppression of their free speech and assembly rights. So we've got your back, internationalists, on that one. Now, several people have already noted we're going to have the greatest collection of the greatest purveyors of violence in the world today, to borrow a phrase, here in Chicago next May. And what I'm going to try and do is set the context for that and from a Chicago point of view. This audience doesn't need to be told that this history has got a long history of police violence, torture, and other mayhem, going all the way back to Haymarket, going up to the 30s, and of course 1968. But what you may not know is that history has continued with a series of legal battles over our right to assemble, the right to exercise our free speech rights. In 2003, the night that the Iraq War began, 15,000 people marched on Lakeshore Drive. It was, by the way, allowed by the Chicago Police Department. Some of us might say they didn't have any choice, but it was allowed by the Chicago Police Department. And in revenge for that march, about an hour or two later, the CPD, despite its long history going all the way back to Haymarket, conducted its largest ever mass arrest in its history. That took some doing. Over 800 of us were arrested in that. All the charges, all the cases were resolved in a manner indicative of the innocence, every single one of them, and now there is a class action lawsuit about that. There are lawsuits subsequent to that because we have found, for example, that the CPD has infiltrated our anti-war organizing efforts, and that's hence the announcement a little bit earlier this morning. And so we are fully cognizant of what the best and brightest of our our city can dish out to us. Just to set a little bit more specific of the Chicago context here, as Joe mentioned, for parade permits, you cannot apply for them under Section 10-8-330 of the Chicago Municipal Code until just a few days after the start of the year. And actually, if the city lives up to its ordinance, we should be expecting an answer to our parade permit request as of January 13th. That is the date that I would encourage people to note, because that's probably going to be a date of some protest or some other kerfuffle at City Hall. As we've found in the past, we've been sued by the City of Chicago over our parade permit applications, and this is just par for the course. There are also financial barriers that the city will probably put in our wake. For past demonstrations where we've attempted to get Daley Plaza for ourselves, but seemingly not for the Tea Partiers, we were required by MB Real Estate at Daley Plaza to get $2 million insurance, not just for our organizers, but for each and every vendor, the porta potty people, the sound and stage people. Now, obviously, I don't have $2 million in our pocket. I don't expect anyone else here does. It was a direct abridgment of our free speech rights. Additionally, the Parks Department, which anyone who knows the geography of the city of Chicago, there are very few open places where you can actually have something downtown. And this especially applies to the opening rally on the Tuesday. You've got people coming off work. You got to have it down in the downtown area, at least for your assembly area. And there are very few open public places. The Parks Department, they for Grant Park, I believe the figure is $5,000 minimum to be allowed to have something there. Now, they bend the rules, of course, for their own events. And unfortunately, we are not the sort of people that they bend those rules for. Just a little bit of information about the cast of characters that we're dealing with. Our lovely Mayor Emanuel served in the Israeli Defense Forces. When he was congressman, he had the distinction of probably having the single most pro-war voting record of any congressman. And of course, he was a hatchet man for all the bank bailouts and the wars of the current Obama administration. The point person for march permits until just a few months ago was a guy by the name of Frank Gross, who in Pittsburgh, the CPD likes to go on field trips, and they took a little field trip to Pittsburgh, and there's this infamous photograph of Frank Gross right in the middle of a phalanx of Chicago police officers with a handcuffed protester kneeling down in front of them that they were taunting. Okay, this is the guy who is, until very recently, the main point person for giving parade permits, march permits in the city of Chicago. One of his close buddies was a guy by the name of James Keating, who used to be the point person on the ground for marches in the downtown area. James Keating was infamous for filing false felony charges against protesters and basically being a number one dick. But don't worry, he's moved on from that job. He is now head of McCormick Place Security. But he has, of course, this will be a national security event, and so he will be playing a lesser role. I think I just want to close out with giving a few reasons why it's important to have permitted marches, and some of us, myself included, and I hope a lot of other Chicagoans are not going to be down for this, not just for the permitted marches, but permitted marches have a role to play for building public opinion against the GA, building public opinion against the war, and that's why they have fought us each and every stage of the game for these permitted marches. Yes, they can sometimes be somnolent, and I would hope that our permitted marches are not somnolent, but permitted marches, frankly, pave the way and provide extra support for the non-permitted action, the resistance. You think back to the 1960s, the war resistors, of course, Bradley Manning today. If they don't have the backing of a large and active peace movement in all its diversity, then those people are put up on felony charges. They're sent to Fort Leavenworth and so forth. What does the city hope to get out of this? This is a big career move for our Mayor Emanuel. I firmly believe he intends to run for the president at some point, 2016, whatever. It's also a big career move for our local law enforcement personnel. They get to be shown that they're big men and women. And I think there's something in terms of the goals that we should attempt to get out of this march, these marches and the other activities. We want to put a kibosh on those career moves. And I think there's ample precedent for the value of putting the kibosh on various thugs' career moves such as this. Think back to the 1968 convention and Hubert Humphrey. Chicago 1968 is now widely seen as being the beginning of the end of the public support for the Vietnam War. Now, it took a lot more than obviously Chicago 68 to end that war. It was the resistance of the Vietnamese, it was the resistance within the military and so forth. But if we can make this to be a dark splotch on the career of Mayor Emanuel and his thugs in uniform, which if any indication of their past activity will show that if we do our jobs right, we will be able to do so, then that will be an important contribution, not just for our local anti-war and peace and justice movement, but for the international peace and justice movement. We need to make these G8 NATO meetings rightfully infamous, not just in this city, but around the world, and have the anti-war sentiment, which is a majoritarian sentiment in this town and around the world, focus on these for being the odious collections of thugs that they are. Not on our side, theirs. Thank you.
Our next speaker, I'm very thrilled and pleased to welcome today. Malik Mujahid is a prominent imam from Chicago. He has a well-known radio show and is a leader in the struggle for immigrant rights here in the city. He's also a founder and leader of the Muslim Peace Coalition and chairman of the Parliament of the World's Religions. Malik Mujahid also was instrumental in building Muslim participation in the April 9th mass march and rally, April 9th in New York City, and is very, very important in uniting the Muslim community with the anti-war movement. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here in the company of those people who probably matter the most for the humanity at this moment. I'm fasting today, and normally I don't accept a speaking engagement while fasting, not because I do not have enough energy, but because it has a set routine which focuses more inward in personal development. While fasting, we think of hunger quite a bit, and interesting enough, we think of a lot of food as well. Thinking of that, I thought I must share with you that the people who are not fasting probably because of the choice, because they do not have anything to eat. We know of Horn of Africa, what type of famine is going there. They say it is bigger than last any famine in last 60 years. But one aspect is less known, and that is that in 2007, Somalia and that region has bumper crop. And when the week that crop was brought to the market, United Nations dumped all the year worth of food supply in the free market in Somalia. On whose order, which meeting decided that, and what will be the implication of it? It took 1 year for them to decide that it was a mistake in 2008. So you wonder, 2009 will be different? When crop all the Somalis brought to the field from the market? They dumped year worth of free supply of all the grain possible in the market. That's what these international mechanisms have developed, mass train, with no regard whatsoever to humanity, for the concern of civilization, and for the people. So my dear brothers and sisters, there is a real meaning to war at home and war abroad. And that meaning was in the best possible way conveyed by Dr. King in his April 4th Riverside speech. But at the same time, it continues to have multiple meanings. Today, Afghans live only 44 years. That's all. 44 years. And each and every country around Afghanistan lives 30 years minimum longer than Afghans. Why Afghans are choosing not to live beyond 44 years? So when I see in your written statement a point that ours is the agenda for humanity's future, I really believe so. And I really thank you not only writing that, but believing in it, but taking a stand in your city and across the world for the truth of it. So what we are going to face is essentially helping everybody else around us realize the truth of that statement, that we are standing for the future of humanity. Are you with me?
Yes. Yes.
So my request to you is that do not take it as an event which will take place on a certain date. This is taking place right now. And my request is that if there are 100 organizations present here, what about each one of that organization taking upon themselves to have at least 100 teach-ins from now until then? Can you do that?
Yes.
Yeah. If we do that, that will be 10,000 teach-ins in the Chicagoland area. And let the mayor of this city realize that he has the historic chance of clearing his name and the name of Chicago from the Haymarket riot, which was not very far from here. Those who are from out of town, it's appropriate to know that history. But also of 68, and also of the arrest of those 900 in Chicago. You gave bad name to Chicago, the father daily, the son daily, and mayor. If you have any chance whatsoever to become president of this country, clear your name right now. And this is your opportunity. We are all committed to nonviolent action. Don't turn that action into violent because of your action of violence. Gandhi was committed to nonviolence, but he has people around him who will be beaten by the colonial powers of that time. Dr. King was committed to nonviolence, and today, Ashley reminded me, is the day of his historic speech of I Have a Dream. But always read that speech of I Have a Dream with the Riverside speech of war at home and war abroad. America is together on this. But there are people who have not turned their opinion against war into action. There are people who have yet to learn how to take their position against all the bank financing by our tax money into action. These days coming up is our opportunity to teach and turn into action.
Eloquent and gracious. Our next speaker is Mark Johnson. Mark is Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the oldest interfaith peace organization in the United States, and I had the pleasure pleasure of meeting him a few days after my home was raided by the FBI. So I'm glad to see him.
Further down the agenda you are, the less there is to say that's new. So the question is how to look at some of the things we're saying in a little bit different way. When we were making plans in these endless long Sunday evening phone calls for our time together here, someone said, why do we need 9 hours together? And I think we're beginning to see the value of a long period of time together. My predecessor was A.J. Mustey. And A.J. Mustey is often referenced as the individual who introduced the phrase, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Mustey was also asked, why did he continue to appear and get arrested in front of the White Houses and the other places that he did? And he said, what do you hope to change? And he said, I don't hope to change anything. I hope not to be changed. So one of the questions we have to answer to people when we leave this space and they ask us, why are we marching, is why should they join us? How should they show up? How do we show up? And I would say that's the first principle. FOR members, we march so that we will not be changed. We will not be moved from what it is we believe. We march in solidarity. We gather in solidarity here today and this weekend. We gain strength by being here together. And that's important in its own right. We're resisting co-optation. Some have bemoaned the decay of the death movement. You know, every day for the last 20 days and for the next 10 days, 50 to 100 people have been arrested on a daily basis in front of the White House, protesting the Keystone Tar Sands agenda. On behalf of FOR, I committed to be there the last day. I put an announcement out over the weekend that I was planning, and the first person to respond was my daughter. And she says, you know, it's not often that your father comes across as someone advertising the fact that he's going off to Washington to be arrested. Maybe they'll have given up by then. This is also the opportunity to gain awareness. How much have we already learned this morning about Toronto, about Minneapolis, St. Paul, about Chicago in the past? You know, Chicago's a great place for this opportunity. I started in this work in the 60s when the Woodlawn Association came to Rochester, New York, where I was born and raised, to help us understand how to respond to the violence that that city was experiencing around inequity and injustice and racial injustice. So we also march to strengthen our hearts and to take courage in this important work. This goes way back. This isn't 10 years or 20 years. You know, this is millennia of work, and it'll be in front of us for a long time to come. FOR has long been known, though I think we probably need to cede our credentials to Code Pink and others, of being an organization that through acts of conscience was present as spectacle. So part of what we need and intend to do is to be a spectacle for the world, to draw attention away from NATO and G8. And Code Pink's doing wonderful work every day somewhere in terms of being a spectacle about lifting up the injustice of the world. We've already mentioned a lot of the giants on whose shoulders we stand, but Gandhi's Satyagraha, the speaking truth to power. Martin Luther King's important message of the strength of love. These are acts of conscience that we perform. In that sense, it doesn't make any difference whether we're successful or not. We're being true to ourselves and we're being true to principles. But we do know that by being true to those, by these acts of conscience, we will make changes. The third reason that we march, the third reason is here, because we are the prophets of the current age. We are the people who will speak truth to power. We are the people who have the responsibility and the capacity. Malik demonstrates it so well, and I'm so pleased to be sandwiched here between Malik and Kathy Kelly, Kathy as well, to be that vision for the world that could be, and to speak truth to that power. We cannot be silent. Whether it's FOR members like Martin Niemöller, who recognized the Nazi move to eradicate the Jews in Germany, who said we cannot be silent, or Martin Luther King, whose memory we have already lifted up more than once, who said we can no longer be silent about the role of the United States in the wars of the world. It is time to speak up and be present and to be prophets for a world that can be. The fourth reason that we gather is because there is no future. There is no future in a paradigm that equates progress with growth. And this is all that NATO and G8 are about, the equation of progress and growth. Our future requires that we engage and still differentiate the sacrifices that we are going to have to make, the gifts of love that we are going to have to make to generations to come, by retrenchment, by retraction, by reduction, by living more softly on the earth, by living in the earth for generations to come, and not for weeks or quarters or annual budgets. I also wanted to say two things in closing. One is, as Malik and others suggested, there's a lot that happens between now and May 15th to 19th, and we need to show up everywhere that something is happening, whether it's in Washington this week, or for October 2011, or the School of the Americas Watch, or the Southcom Action. We need to show up everywhere that something is happening to bring those people with us here come May. So it's not only the teach-ins. I want to draw attention to, I don't see it on the agenda, I know we've talked about it, that another group that has formed around the May event is the Network for a NATO-Free World and a Global Peace and Justice. And a number of us are a part of that organizing as well. We're going to have a teach-in here, a day-long conference, bringing people from around the world on the 18th.
It's in a breakout.
Okay, great. That's good. I also want to tell a story in closing. In 1953, again, A.J. Musty, my predecessor, heard rumors of the appointments of a young black pastor in Montgomery, Alabama, to the Montgomery Improvement Association. His name was Martin Luther King, a recent graduate in a new pulpit. Musty sent A.J. Musty and Glenn Smiley, A.J. Musty sent Bayard Rustin and Glenn Smiley to Montgomery to begin the long and important process of educating Martin Luther King Jr. to nonviolence. The success of that boycott led in 1958 to the production of a little comic book, a graphic novel, 1958, that told the story of the success of active, creative nonviolence. Not passive, dispassionate, active, creative nonviolence. This comic book was recently translated into Arabic and Farsi and Vietnamese, was used in Tunisia and Egypt. In advance of, you know, Jim Lawson, James Farmer, John Lewis, they all talk about the weekends they spent passing this comic book out on the corners in Nashville and Memphis in preparation for events. We need to be producing graphic comic books, little zines, kinds of materials between now and then to educate the larger population as to why they want to be a part of what we're doing May 12th, 15th, 19th, and on and on.
Mark mentioned that our next speaker that we are so happy to and honored to have here today is Kathy Kelly. She's a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's known around the world for her opposition to the economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. and U.N. against the Iraqi people between 1990 and 2003. But she's also been a longtime activist in solidarity with the most oppressed people around the world, particularly in Latin America, and most recently in Pakistan and Afghanistan. She told me last night that she was a teacher And she continues to be a teacher and to teach us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to start working on those 100 teach-ins that we're going to have between now and May. Thanks, Malika. It's a privilege to be here with all of you. I think maybe a tie that binds all of us, although to our Canadian friends, I'm not familiar enough with your constitution, but we are strict constructionists. I think of at least one part of our constitution that says Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for the redress of grievance. And we have a grievance. There's a young boy named Zekrullah. If he could be here with us, I'm sure he would be delighted. But I think his story helps me better understand that grievance. Zekrullah is such a hard worker. He lives in Afghanistan. And every morning he's up to do the daily chores, but at least about three times a month he has to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. He takes a 6-hour ride to a mountainside that hasn't yet been denuded of scrub brush and twigs and things that they can gather for fuel. Because you see, 10 years into the occupation of Afghanistan, still in the central highlands of Afghanistan, people don't have electricity, even though it's a rather calm space where the United States and NATO could have perhaps created conditions wherein electricity could be gotten. They had other agendas in mind. In a land where 850 children die every single day, while the US and the NATO and the G8 have other agendas in mind. So Zekrullah goes on this long journey to the mountainside, and on each side of his donkey he has a basket full of twigs and scrub brush and what can be used for fuel for their family. And he comes back home, another 6-hour ride on the donkey, and he loads the scrubs and the scrub brush and the twigs on the family home. And then he's pretty tired by then, but he goes out to pull potatoes out of the ground or plant the potatoes and then make another long trip for water. Now, he lives in the province of Bamyan in the central highlands of Afghanistan. But in nearby provinces like the province of Kunar, it's really only the most poor and the most desperate families that will send those children out to that mountainside in Kunar to gather the fuel, even though children have done this traditionally for centuries. And that's because these children now might be in the crosshairs of some of the most fearsome aerial vehicles produced in the world. These are the helicopter gunships. Their engines are the same engines that are in an Abrams tank. The United States is quickly making 150 more just to fly over the skies of Afghanistan. And on March 1st, there were 9 children from the province of Kunar out on a mountainside collecting the twigs and the firewood and the scrub brush. And suddenly they heard one of these helicopter gunships overhead. And it hovered overhead, and then there was a green flash, and then suddenly it went way high up, came down, and executed in cold blood each one of those 9 children between the ages of 7 and 15. And the parents, having heard the explosions on the mountainside, went racing, their hearts trembling, and then they found the dismembered bodies of their children who had committed no crime, and puddles of blood. And there was one who survived to tell the story. And so you see, when Andy says, it's not a word I use often myself, but I'm confronted by it. When Andy says that there are thugs, you know, we usually think of somebody who's going to hit you from behind. But if we continue to say, oh, it's okay, if we continue to say, we'll go to sleep, we'll avert our gaze, we won't look, then we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves, how long will we continue to bankroll the people who are killing children in our name, who have created measures all around the world that don't in any way make anyone more secure, least of all ourselves, or the children that we love in this country and in Canada and around the world who deserve a far better future. And so our responsibility is very great. Chicago is a wonderful city, but we have to acknowledge to you who are from out of town that during a Memorial Day parade in this city, 6,000 young children, teenagers, high schoolers, were dressed up in maybe the most expensive clothing they'd ever put on their bodies in their lives, full dress uniforms, 6,000 junior ROTC youngsters being trained to join the military. And I would submit that NATO and the G8 leaders that will assemble here don't care about those youngsters any more than they care about Sekhrullah. These kids are not their agenda. And so I hope that every young kid in Chicago will be better tuned in by the time we're finished with our 100 teach-ins apiece. And they'll know what G8 means. They'll know what NATO actually means. And I hope that these youngsters here in Chicago will be ready to say, we're throwing a retirement party for that crowd. We don't need them. We've learned a lot from them. We've learned how not to behave. And we've learned that we want to become a generation, a why not generation, that will ask, why not recognize that we are all part of one another? A what if generation? What if we didn't have to bankroll the murderous and thieving groups that are creating a jeopardized planet and a precarious future for people all around the world? And so, yes, let us join together. Let us see ourselves as strict constructionists, that there shall be no way of deterring our determination to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. And we'll tell the truth about that grievance. We'll grieve the lives lost, and we'll look forward to a far better future. Thank you to all the organizers.
Thank you, Kathy. Our last speaker for this panel is Alejandro Molina. Alejandro is a member of the National Boricua Human Rights Network, a human rights organization of Puerto Ricans in the U.S. and their supporters. He is also an educator at Dr. Pedro Albizu Campos High School in Chicago, and he also was one of the people that showed up to defend us when my own was raided the very next day. I was so glad to see you then, and I'm really glad to see you again this morning.
First of all, I wanted to thank everybody for being present, and I definitely want to thank the speakers that came before me. There's a lot of knowledge here. But I also noticed that there are elements missing to those of us present. I think that one of the jobs, our job, in raising consciousness and in carrying out education is not just the mass mobilization to take place in May, but the work that precedes it. On those conference calls that you made reference to, those long conference calls, I've raised the idea of wanting to help distribute a curriculum, a one-hour curriculum for high school and university students. I think Kathy points out quite rightly that the Army, the military, is a viable economic alternative for youth in our communities, those youth in low income and communities of color. How do we change that? Not just by education. I think those projects, like our high school, like self-help projects in the community that start to offer an alternative to either drug trafficking, right, to gang banging, it's not just the uniform, right? It is the money that we have to talk about. The organization I represent, the National Boricua Human Rights Network, has a long history of fighting for human rights, particularly in the Puerto Rican diaspora and in Puerto Rico, around human rights, around the militarization and occupation and bombardment of Vieques, Puerto Rico, but in particular around the defense and the campaign to free several generations of Puerto Rican political prisoners. Beginning with the five Puerto Rican nationalists who attacked Congress on May 1st, 1954. Lolita Lebron led a commando of Puerto Rican nationalists and spent 25 years in prison before they were pardoned by President Jimmy Carter in September of 1979. April 1980, for those of you from Chicago, was, I would say, a transformative moment in our history, as 11 Puerto Rican revolutionaries were arrested in the suburb of Evanston, Illinois, and charged with seditious conspiracy, as well as minor arms violations. Seditious conspiracy is conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States by force of arms. In this case, it was in Puerto Rico. Those 11 men and women went on to serve, most of them, 20 years in prison before they were pardoned, after a worldwide campaign in 1999 by President Bill Clinton. Two long-term Puerto Rican political prisoners remained. One was freed again after an intensive campaign. Carlos Alberto Torres walked out of prison on July 25th, also a historic date, of last year, and was greeted by over 600 people in Humboldt Park, and then went to Puerto Rico the next day, where he was welcomed at the airport by over 3,000 people after spending 30 years in prison. I say this because part of our task as activists, and as activists, I would hope that people understand that we're also educators, right? Is how do we build that historical memory, which talks about war being wrong? How do we build memory among our youth about Oscar Lopez Rivera, who has served 30 years in prison, many of whom are just learning the name many years after he's been incarcerated? Before they were born, he was in jail. He served more time in jail than many people that we teach in our community. How do we talk about the righteousness of the campaign to free him? How do we talk about war being wrong? We all have different beliefs, I believe, and that's what makes this coalition powerful, right? We all either teach or sing or preach or walk or protest, right? But we all have one goal, and that is to teach our youth that a better world is possible. How do we come to an agreement abroad to mobilize, but more importantly, in order to mobilize, to do these teach-ins in the face of this escalating economic crisis where youth are cannon fodder, where youth have no sense of place in their communities? I believe that's the challenge before us. And I say we, on behalf of the network and the Puerto Rican Latino community, we're pledging to construct a feeder march for the NATO G8 protests. We encourage everyone to bring as many people as they can, but more importantly, to put together this curriculum so we can start the important work of educating our youth, be they in high school and university, that we look to these creative differences in our coalition to strengthen and build our numbers. Thank you.